I'm Christopher Lydon in Trivandrum, the southernmost big city in India, with the novelist and short story writer of Kerala, Paul Zakaria. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Paul Zakaria, I feel those monsoon rains coming any moment, but let's plunge. I was so pleased when you said you would share your confusion about this mystery, this muddle of what it is that India is going through. We believe in novelists, I should tell you, as the tailspinners who see the invisible and make up the details in stories, so to speak. Let me ask you, though, bluntly, do you see a new India taking form?
Yes, Chris, I think there certainly is a new India taking form, taking shape. And it's something that people like me thought would never happen, say, 15 years back. Because, everything is determined by politics. So the politics of those days didn't show any signs of a new India coming up. But I think things changed. I'm not saying that it's changed from socialism to capitalism, but it certainly changed from socialism to something more positive. A lot of production of wealth, a lot of production of goods and services, lots of people are getting employed, and there is certainly a kind of wealth is being spread out up to a point. There is more wealth in the society now than ever before, which I think is very important for a society. But when you ask me this question, I must also add that finally, at the end of the day, something like 40% of the Indian people are still very poor. And there is this tremendous gap between wealth that is being created somewhere and whether it filters down to the people or not.
We read that 50% of Indian children are malnourished. And we also wonder, I must say, why socialism didn't address this. Almost 50 years of socialist ideals didn't seem to dent that
at all. Socialism was just a slogan, ultimately. Socialism was used to hold capital in a few hands, like you say it happens in capitalism. But this was worse than that, because the state, the politicians, the officials, and wealthy people who were close to them, so the whole wealth was held by a small clique of people. So socialism was used as a label to justify all the controls, all the way they squeeze the Indian economy for their own benefits. So like it has happened in all the in many of the communist countries, it was just a useful tag. It was nothing more than that.
We see these office parks. We know about Bangalore. You can't miss the evidence of a new prosperity. But how deep do you expect it to go in terms of that grinding poverty at the very broad bottom?
There is a growth of the middle class, and that's why a whole lot of consumer goods companies from all over the world are finding India as a big market, because there is a huge middle class growing. And that growth, unless there is a calamity of sorts, let's say a war with a neighboring country or something like that, unless there is a calamity of some such kind, I think this growth will not stop.
Where does a novelist see all those other kinds of change? Family change, urban India, for example, really eclipsing village India. But speak of those other changes that you think run deep, if you do.
As the wealth comes into the hands of people, they are exploring so many other areas of experience which wealth can buy. That certainly has an impact on family life, on relationships, etc., etc. But all these things are changing the way the traditional Indian mind used to work. The traditional Indian mind is now moving in a direction where it is taking in things from all over the world.
For example?
You see, what the television brings into the Indian family, into the typical middle-class Indian home, is something that Indians, the kind of relationships in fiction, the kind of in television fiction, I mean, in through films and other things, is something that Indian families would never have thought of accepting into either their lives or even witnessing in a film, because Indian films depict a romantic world where things are all completely different. So that is one area. The other area is where people, the entrepreneurs and others are going out boldly and investing wealth all over the world. People from Kerala, a small state like Kerala, are going out to China, are going out to East Europe and places like that, and making investments. So which means there is a new sense of confidence, there is a new sense of courage which is taking them out, which never used to happen. We used to, sit behind things, you know, when it came to going out and facing the world.
Hmm. You're a Kerala man, and you write a lot of your fiction in Malayalam, the language of Kerala. Can you explain Kerala to us? Very, very successful, mostly communist state since independence. What's the secret? And how much of it has to do with Karl Marx? How much of it has to do with Buddha? How much of it has to do with something else entirely?
Whatever. It had a lot to do with Marx at a point of time. When in the 50s, communism came into Kerala as a movement, as a cultural movement, mind you, not even a political movement. Some politics was behind it, but it was not a political party at that time. So communism helped a lot, it helped a lot in removing a whole lot of feudalistic values from the Kerala society, at the cultural level, at the social level, and also at the economic level. It had that very positive effect at that point of time. But after that, when they became a political party, the Communist Party of India came to power here, they became like any other political party, corrupt, inefficient, and heartless. They became the masters and the people became the slaves, which is right now the same thing is happening. We have a communist government here where they are the masters. They think they are the masters of the universe, and the people are people who just, you know, beg and hang around, you see.
Even in the States, Kerala is famous for being different in the relation of men and women, in the almost universal literacy,
yeah,
in the relative equality of economic groups. How do you explain it?
Yeah, as I said, this happened after the communist movement came in, and there was what we call the period, it was a period of enlightenment.
Hmm.
And that led to, at that point of time, even the government was influenced by those ideas of economic and political enlightenment, not the European enlightenment. A period where, as I said, we were coming out of the feudalistic period. And the foundations were laid during the 60s and 70s. And then things started collapsing. But even today, to answer your question more precisely, Kerala doesn't produce any wealth. There are hardly any industries here. Tourism is the only industry that has worked here for the first time in Kerala's history, and it's making some money. But beyond that, there's no production of wealth except salaries. But so where does all the wealth come from? Something like 100,000 or more Keralites working in the US, in the Gulf, in Europe, in Southeast Asia, in Russia, in China. These people bring in an annual income which is something like 5 times the sum of the Kerala budget. That is the money that you see here. That is the prosperity you see here. The government does not create any prosperity. It only puts obstacles when somebody starts doing something. So the prosperity you see here is created by people working at least 5,000 to 6,000 miles away somewhere and sending money home.
Should Kerala be embarrassed about that?
I don't think so, because in the last 60 years, the governments that ruled Kerala have literally kicked these young people out. They are not laborers. Most of them are highly educated people who could have been an asset to this society, who could have rebuilt up the society into something wonderful. They are all working for Americans and Germans and the Arabs. You know, if something happens to the world tomorrow, not to India, but something happens to Europe or to US or to the Gulf, then things will collapse here. Then we will be in a deep soup.
We've heard this from students, that they come out of Kerala very well educated, very well aware of the world, but without a livelihood here.
That's right. Without a livelihood, because there is hardly any... To tell you the truth, I mean, this is a primary fact, is that every family, as soon as a boy or a girl is born, they target him, they focus him in a path where he can leave the state in the next 14 years, 12 years to 14 years.
Interesting.
Yeah. Every training, every thinking given to him, orientation given to him, is how to get out and go. As soon as you have a qualification that will enable you to get out.
That's a gift to the world, but it is an indictment, I think, of Kerala. Could I ask you, stand back. You've been watching India for 50 years, maybe. If you had to list one, two, or at the most three profound changes in your country, its culture, its family life, its thinking, as well as its industry and its economics, what would you name?
I think one of the most profound changes that, and it's also in a way quite frightening, is what happened to India after the demolition of the Babri Masjid in Ayodhya.
This was, a right-wing Hindu riot against...
Yeah, the right-wing Hindu thing. And it seemed as if... And then the right-wing Hindu party, the BJP, came to power. And it seemed as if a fascist force had swallowed this nation, and things were coming to whatever India that we all knew, whatever India that we had experienced, a liberal, open India, at least culturally, it seemed as if it was coming to a close. But what really happened was, that went on for about, I think the BJP rule happened for about 7, 8 years or whatever, and then they were thrown out. The very same people who elected them removed them. And so the right-wing Hindus were removed by a majority of Hindus who believed in other values for whom fascist politics was not valid. This is an amazing thing that happened, because it looked as if the majority Hindu India was behind the right-wing party. It was not. The majority Hindu India still continues to be an open-minded, very liberal, and, it embraces all kinds of change, and it is open to change and the future. So this kind of a somersault is, to me, the most important thing that I have seen in Indian history recently. This is a resurgence of the Hindu mind, of the Hindu people. That is what we into a modern mindset.
Paul Zakaria, you're a storyteller and a novelist. Will you give us something out of your own fiction that expresses this kind of edge that you feel the country is on?
Yeah, I think there's one story called The Train Robbery, where a poor man who has a wife and a child, they have been marginalized for years by the mainstream politics. They're poor. And there's a point at which he wonders what to do, how to make some money. He has tried everything. He has been a communist. He has been a congressman. He has watched all the politicians and their people going by in processions. He has watched others growing rich. But he has not been able to make it. So he thinks the best way is to rob a train, to become a train robber. He has a small son, he's a young son. He takes the son in as a kind of fellow robber. So there's a fruit called a papaya, which if you roll it up in newspaper, it would look like a bomb of sorts, something like a big grenade. So that's the only thing that he can think of as a something to frighten people with.
A vegetable bomb.
A fruit bomb. They were keeping it for 2-3 days, waiting for the inspiration to go. So by that time it had ripened, actually. So they take this and go to the railway track. And he has imagined in the meanwhile what he will do once he gets into the train, how they will scare the people, take money and put into the pocket. All these things he has gone through. So he knows a particular train that passes at a particular time. But then he needs something to stop the train by. So he goes to the Communist Party office. He was a Communist Party worker. Because he has seen red flags lying on the veranda. So he decides to borrow a flag, because it's after the last demonstration, it's been just left there. It won't be used. But the party, they're holding a meeting in the committee meeting in the office. One of them watches him take the flag out. And they shout at him and says, "Put the flag back. You may be a member of the party, but you have no business to take flags away. When we say take it, you will take it. Otherwise, it will lie there." So he doesn't have a flag, because otherwise he thought he will stand on the track and show the red flag and the train will stop. So now he has no other way, but he just goes with his son to the railway track, and he keeps the son stands. It's a kind of embankment. Son stands downstairs and he tells his son that the train has been my friend for a long time, so maybe it will stop when it sees me. So he holds up the papaya in his hand and stands before the train. And as the train approaches and the son can see that he is going to be run over, the son cries, calling out, "Father, jump, get away, you know, the train is going to hit you." And he looks at his son's face and then he jumps before the train hits him. And then, well, the train hurtles past and, you know, it disappears with the whistle and everything. And so the father and son goes back home. The revolution is over. They have not been able to achieve anything. Mm-hmm. Then he opens the paper. Then he finds that the fruit is ripe. So he had brought a small knife to frighten people with when he gets in the train. So with that knife, he opens he cuts the fruit, gives a piece to his son, eats a small piece for himself, and takes the fruit back home to his wife. The rest of the fruit, that's the story.
That's fascinating. Well, Paul Zakaria, what do you think is the connection in Indian culture, especially between poverty and happiness, between poverty and revolution, between poverty and social anger? Your man was tempted, but when the time came, his happiness was with his son and his wife.
Yeah, you see, ultimately, the poor has only that consolation. At the end of the day, the consolation is only whatever little bit of human relationships they are allowed to have, because a whole lot of it vanishes as hunger hits you. As hunger hits you, you are in no mood to create relationships or sustain it. But they manage it. And I think this is how revolution has been using poverty as a kind of stick, as a kind of weapon to create its own power structure. But it never removed poverty, Communist Party, the rest of it. So everyone has been using poverty as an aid for themselves. Mm-hmm. Congressmen have been doing it, communists have been doing it, and the right-wing Hindu Party has been doing it. So for all of them, the common man, the poor man, is their most convenient tool, to come to power, and then they forget about the common man.
Of course, that's exactly what a lot of people we've met say the Maoists are doing with the tribal areas. What do you think?
I think the Maoists are people who have really come to the end of their tether. they are sick and tired of what has been happening to them over the last 60 years. Just today I read the Chief Minister of Bihar, Nitish Kumar, saying that Maoists have a genuine cause. They are rebellious because they have suffered, which is a very important statement to have come from a Chief Minister of a state. There is a perception that the word MAO, Mao, it doesn't mean a thing. They are using that as their identity, but their problems are, it can be, they can call themselves Christians or Jesus men or Buddha men or whatever. But the cause is very genuine.
Hmm. Paul Zakaria, I want to know where your writing comes from, who your formative storytellers are in India, in the wider world.
Well, if it is from the United States, well, I can mention Hemingway was one of my most favorite writers, especially his short stories. But I grew up with his novels too, a whole lot. And a poet who influenced me as a student and then continues to influence me is T.S. Eliot, who has really created a whole structure of approaching language for me. You know, I still keep rereading him, or Dylan Thomas, for example, again, Dylan. And Lewis Carroll is a man I grew up with. Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass.
Yes.
The two of them combined. See, that's the first English book I ever got as a present, and I was very, very small at that time. I think I must have been 11 or 12 or 10 or 11, and I could just put together English words, just put together and read. And then my brother sent me that book as a present, and I struggled through that book for months trying to get at what was inside it. And then I've been reading and rereading it till today. I keep rereading it whenever I just want to feel good, because it's an amazing, you know, the way he plays with words, how he changes the entire, one word can, you know, go flying in several directions, you know. And it's not the magical world or anything of that he has created, but it's an amazing sense of humor. So, talking about humor, I am a lover of your James Thurber, for example.
Yes.
Thurber has been, I keep rereading him and seeing his cartoons.
That's wonderful. Can I ask a question about America? I'm very, very eager to know how Indians feel about the United States these days, most especially because the governments have been very, very close for the last 10 years. But how about the country, the people, the culture, the movies, the music?
America can be very scaring for Indians once they think that one of their people is going to be in America.
Mm.
And you know there are millions of Indians now in America.
Yes.
And people sitting here are quite worried that either a white boy or girl or a black boy or girl might get there, boy or girl, you see. It's quite frightening.
Is it a racial fear fundamentally?
It's not a racial fear. It's not racism. You know that if your son marries an American white girl or a black girl, or your daughter marries an American white boy or a black boy, it means that that part of your family, more or less family tree, comes to an end there. That the tradition that was keeping the boy or girl inside it, that tradition comes to an end. And Indian families are very traditionalist. So this kind of a break, one of their members getting lost into the other wide world is something that frightens them. I know my friends who live in the U.S. This is a major threat.
Paul Zakaria, I want to ask you one more question about the American connection. And specifically Afghanistan, not so far from here. Although everybody says Indians don't think about it, and yet Afghanistan is where India comes from. Going back to Babur, it's the mother country in a certain strange way. What does India think of the war in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan exists only in the newspapers. It appears in the English newspapers quite a lot. It is almost non-existent in language newspapers unless an explosion happens and 60 people are killed or 100 people are killed. So what happens in Afghanistan is the concern of a world which is far away from the normal existing life in India.
What do you make of it yourself, the global war on terror, on the Taliban, Al-Qaeda?
I think the global war on terror is an industry which has been promoted by the United States. It's an industry which will go on. I think the armament manufacturers are in it. All those Bible-thumping Christian fundamentalists are in it. And a lot of industrialists are in it. And lots of people are minting money and becoming millionaires in this process. There are terrorists. I am not saying that there are not terrorists. But this other process of the so-called, creation of a protagonist and then going to destroy him. And Afghanistan was not taken over. I don't think it was because Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11. We all know that. Why was it attacked? So because?
Well, Afghanistan was the home address of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, that makes no difference. So many criminals come out of all kinds of countries. You can't. And bin Laden doesn't live in Afghanistan anymore. Everyone knows he's right there in Pakistan, having a good life.
How does the war end, in your view? Or does it never end?
I don't think it's going to end until and unless the people of America get sick of seeing their sons coming back in long boxes. Once they say, we have killed enough of our young boys, stop it, then it might come to an end. But then the industry that is supporting the war may not still agree with that. Because a war is the only process where the people's will cannot be asserted. Because then the ruling classes take over. It's a favorite hobby and a favorite pursuit of the ruling classes. And the ordinary man who has lost his son, the father and mother, well, he's supposed to have lost the son for patriotic cause. And patriotism is the last resort of a rascal and a rogue.
You know, almost a year ago, Barack Obama went to a school in Texas, I think, and a girl asked him, in all the world, in history, even in fiction, if you could have dinner with one man or woman, who would it be? He thought rather a long time and he said, Mahatma Gandhi. And not long after that, Rajmohan Gandhi, Gandhi's grandson, was speaking with us, and I asked, what would Mahatma Gandhi tell Barack Obama about the world and about specifically the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? And he said basically, Gandhi would say, put your mind, your heart in the place of your so-called adversary and be specially aware of the imbalance of power. But I wonder what your own thought is. If Barack Obama did have dinner with Gandhi in that beautiful picture on your wall, what do you suppose Gandhi would say? To a man who at least wants to listen.
Gandhi would say something that would be impossible to do. Like what Gandhi would tell Obama would be something that Obama, who is just a puppet of all the people who pull the strings in the US, like any other president, Gandhi is going to tell him, forgive these people, like Jesus would have told him. Which is impossible. Forgiveness doesn't exist in politics. Only revenge works. When Obama says he respects Gandhi, he's merely echoing a certain common feeling. He's almost sloganeering. It is just a slogan, convenient thing to say. I don't think any politician in the world today can speak about Gandhi.
I came to India with this thought that we may have entered the century of India. So much talent, and it's found its groove in a certain way. As you say, at the bottom, this is an open, liberal society that embraces change and embraces the future. What is the chance? And what would be the justice of India having a much, much bigger role in the leadership of the world?
That's a long haul, actually. Because China has been able to, I don't know, I have never been to China, I only hear and read about it. China apparently has been able to mobilize people right at the bottom. Maybe it has something to do with the Chinese society. Maybe it has something to do with the communist movement, which had provided education at the lowest level, I don't know how, but they have made an extraordinary overdrive. It's a kind of high jump into another world from one era to another. But for India, to do that would be a very long haul with something like 40% of this 1 billion still down and under. So whatever high jump you're taking, this will always drag you back. So beyond a point, this high jump cannot be a sustainable thing, because here is, while the jumpers would be jumping very high, these guys would be lying at the bottom. If somebody can change that, then they would have changed India. But that seems very hard, because it is not the government in New Delhi that has to do it. Of course, it has to lay out the policies, but it is each state government that has to do it.
People have said to me that India is the last country where you'll ever see a revolution. What do you think?
I think so. It'll be very hard to have a revolution.
I wonder why.
I think the last revolution we saw was Mahatma Gandhi mobilizing the people against the British. After that, there is no cause out there. There's nothing, a single point of belief, a single ideal, and a great man who can hold up that ideal and say, look at me, I am truthful, I am honest, I am transparent, I have nothing to hide, and this is the ideal we shall follow. And there is no such person after Gandhi. So I doubt if such a person can come up from in the present kind of politics. I'm sure there are individuals, hundreds or maybe thousands and lakhs of individuals in India who have that mind, but they will never be able to come to the top and lead the people in the political system that we right now have here. So a revolution is impossible. Communist Party attempted it and failed miserably, and in fact shamefully. And I will say the only revolution that keeps recurring is the revolution the water creates every 5 years. That keeps democracy intact. So I will say every 5 years there is a revolution in India, and that is something like very close to half a billion people going to the polling booth and putting his vote in. That is a silent revolution, and that keeps this whole place going. The people we elect are indifferent, inefficient, and useless, but they keep democracy in place.
Paul Zakaria, it is a great pleasure to hear you talk, and we go out wiser than we came in. I'm hugely grateful for your work, your life, and this conversation.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.